From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as immigration agents push to enact President Trump's agenda on immigrants, the Wayne County Sheriff's Department pushes back.
We will not engage in a practice of what we believe to be borderline profiling, where we merely just tame people based upon their race or ethnicity.
Overcoming infertility, the many ways to build a family.
We want them to realize that they're not alone and that we feel their pain and that they will find a resolution somehow, some way.
The State House considers a bill that would force drivers to put down our handheld cell phones.
The bill still allows for us to use these devices when we're driving. The key is that they have to be voice activated. In other words, you can't be engaged with it visually or physically.
But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, there's nothing like having your car totaled by a driver who is probably playing Pokemon Go to sharpen your focus on distracted driving. That's what happened to State Representative Martin Horelak, even as the Troy Republican was writing his House Bill 4466. It zeroes in on drivers and their handheld cell phones. Representative Horelak joins us now from the floor of the State House. Welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Tell us more about your accident. What happened?
Oh, well, the accident actually was happened about the time we were wrapping up drafting the first iteration of this bill. But Big Beaver Road, Troy, Michigan, sitting at a traffic light at Crooks Road, and the young lady that hit me was going about 42 miles an hour and had been very actively engaged with her handheld mobile device to the extent that she didn't realize there was stopped traffic ahead, and I was the first vehicle that she hit.
Wow, and she was playing Pokemon Go.
We believe so, she had certainly mentioned on numerous occasions that she was very actively involved with her handheld device.
What happened to your car?
Totaled.
And you were really lucky, weren't you, to get away only with a total car. I saw the Michigan State Police testified in support of your bill this week before the House Transportation Committee. 42 people killed because of distracted driving last year in Michigan, and that is a 50% increase from the year before.
And it's climbing, and part of the challenge we have with getting the absolute numbers is that, you know, if the box isn't checked at the accident scene, so we believe that those numbers are actually underreporting the severity of the situation. So it's definitely, and certainly anecdotally, we can certainly claim that there's a lot going on the roads other than people just driving.
Yeah. So what's in your bill?
So the bill still allows for us to use these devices when we're driving. The key is that they have to be voice activated. In other words, you can't be engaged with it visually or physically, hands on the wheel, or at least one hand on the wheel and eyes looking straight ahead. That's what we're trying to do. So therefore, you know, if you want to use your phone, it needs to be voice activated, or if you need to wake it up a one swipe, one touch, or you can start the conversation before you enter the vehicle. Passengers are not affected by this. They can still use their devices as they see fit.
And what would be the penalties if police pull someone over for using a handheld cell phone?
Sure. In reality, the first offense is probably going to be a warning, but the first time they actually write you up would be a $250 fine, no points. Second offense, $500 and a point, and then third offense, $500 and 2 points. The benefit of this is think about the other alternative, which is either a reckless or a careless driving citation. That's either 6 and 3 points, and I think that this better fits the violation that's happening as well.
So Bluetooth conversations, voice-activated conversations could continue, although doesn't the science tell us that we are just as distracted if we're talking via Bluetooth as we are if we're holding the phone?
So keep in mind that that starts with the premise that people are actually looking at the road and their hands are actually engaged with the steering wheel. So we're not even going down the road, no pun intended, we're not even going down the pathway of trying to decipher what is more or less distracted. All we're saying, we're focusing on this issue of hand engagement with the steering wheel and visual engagement with the road.
Get people off email and Facebook and Pokemon Go and Twitter and everything else they're trying to do. I'm curious, Representative, how has banning handheld devices worked out in other states? Has it made a difference in death rates?
Absolutely. In 2008, California was one of the pioneers to pass such legislation. And we know that 2 years before the statute went into effect versus 2 years after, what we saw happen is the number of deaths attributed to people that are engaged with their electronic devices. The number of distracted driving deaths went down by 47%, and number of distracted driving accidents went down by 22%. That's a pretty monumental change.
What kind of response are you getting from your fellow lawmakers? I know the bill's in committee right now before the House Transportation Committee. What are you hearing from fellow lawmakers?
So naturally, there are a lot of questions. People want to know how the bill would actually work, you know, what limitations would be placed on a driver. And once folks understand that it's just a matter of, again, getting people visually engaged with the road as opposed to some other distraction in the vehicle and hands engaged with the steering wheel, we're finding there to be support. The one thing I do want to point out is the current statute that we have right now only talks about text messaging. And at the very least, that language is incredibly outdated because of the number of things you can do on a handheld electronic device.
Trying to keep up with technology and people's behavior behind the wheel.
Indeed.
If your bill winds up being signed into law by the governor, if it gets through and becomes law, what do you hope it might mean for all of us on the roads?
Well, hopefully we can all have a safer driving experience. And again, it's not only about the driver, it's about everybody else on the road as well as the passengers. One thing I want to point out is that 2016 versus 2015, the number of deaths overall in Michigan went up by 6%. We've passed the 1,000 mark again on the wrong way. We're seeing increasing traffic crashes, accidents, and wrecks, and the increases are mostly attributable to distracted driving. So hopefully we can save some lives, save some people some money and the hassle of having to get your car fixed.
Troy Representative Martin Hoverlack, his House Bill 4466, making it illegal for Michigan drivers to use handheld cell phones. So we can keep our eye on that bill as it goes through the House. Thanks so much for your time, Representative.
Thank you.
Detroit's reinvention continues to gather momentum. This week, a new survey of business leaders delivered a powerful boost for Detroit's future as a place where businesses, large and small, believe they can make a difference. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. We're talking about the Kresge Foundation's Detroit Reinvestment Index. Just what is that?
Essentially, it's a survey of business leaders. Last year, it was focused mostly on national-level business leaders. And it was pretty positive. This year, they've innovated it a little bit and included local, as in Metro Detroit, not just City of Detroit, but Metro Detroit, and which includes some city people, in the survey. And so you're tracking two kind of different groups here. And what's interesting is the people who are here and actually living and working in the community and listening to your show and reading my column or not, and just living their lives and going about their business are actually more bullish about Detroit in some ways than the national people are. But even the national folks are very bullish about Detroit, see it as a city that is hungry for investment, is looking for investment, government that is creating an environment where people want to invest. The other thing that I think is really positive is that folks look at this and they say, this is possible. I mean, for a lot of years, there have been a lot of people in this community who have said, you know, Detroit's never going to change. It's never going to come back, reinvent, revitalize, pick your word. And I think what you're hearing from a lot of people is, yes, it can. And what's also remarkable is if you go down and you look at, I was just down there again last night for an event, it's amazing how it changes on a weekly basis.
I agree with you. We went to the Tiger game last night and drove down Woodward and back up Woodward. And I agree with you. You go, hey, where was that? I didn't see that the last time.
I was over on Washington Boulevard going up to a new wine bar, which is very cool. You should check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed at how many people were walking from pretty far away, just walking across town, going to the game. It was something to see.
Now, what is it you think, do we know from this survey, what business leaders see in Detroit that gives them what they need to succeed?
Well, I think they see pent-up demand, and I think they see opportunity. I mean, you know, I've talked to people in the Quicken organization or Dan Gilbert's Rock Ventures organization who for a lot of years, one of the reasons they were buying up so many buildings is because, as one person said to me, they're giving them away. And when you look at the values, the real estate values, they continue to be less than other major cities. And I think there is pent-up demand here. And there's, you know, there are people from New York that are coming in here and doing projects. Now, they will tell you privately that it's not always easy to do things in the city, that you still have bureaucracies you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a lot of good bones in this town. You go down and you look at these buildings, as you have recently done, and you see, wow, these things, there's a lot you can do with these things. They have a lot of character. And you go into some of these buildings, and I've been into some events, and it's just mind-blowing. mind-blowing what's being done with them.
And what does this survey tell us about businesses not led by names like Penske or Illich or Gilbert? Is there stuff there for the small business person and the entrepreneur?
Yes, and I think, in fact, a lot of what this focus on is entrepreneurs. It's not just the big names, as you say. It's people that are doing small, want to do small businesses. And the younger people got in this survey, the more optimistic they are. The other thing that I thought is interesting is that when it comes to a racial breakdown, whites are as optimistic as people of color. I was expecting to see a little bit of a disparity there, or, I mean, it's 1 or 2 percentage points between the two, but basically it's they're even. That surprised me a little bit, and I think that's encouraging that you don't have negativity coming from either side.
This narrative we've heard of the two Detroits, the place with the cool wine bars and the new bistro versus the neighborhoods, will this pump out and start to be felt in neighborhoods?
Well, I think that's the hope. I mean, the big names that you mentioned a minute ago, if you listen to them publicly, one of the things, now that a lot of what they've planned is in play and underway, although Dan Gilbert still's got to do his big high-rise building on the Hudson site, mm-hmm. which I think is coming fairly soon. But you hear them talk, and they talk a lot about the neighborhoods. And the reason they do is because they're very sensitive to the criticism you just aired. They realize that a lot of people look at this and say, this is all about rich guys who live in the suburbs doing stuff downtown.
Yeah.
And it doesn't help us in the neighborhoods. And I think you're starting to, I know you're starting to see them focus not only rhetorically, but other organizations, again, Kresge, which is spending a lot of money on various projects in Detroit, focusing on neighborhoods. Mayor Duggan is focusing very much on neighborhoods, has been. I think that's, frankly, part of his election campaign. And he's very close to Gilbert and Illich, as any mayor would be, considering what they're investing in his city. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to continue to see emphasis on the neighborhoods, but that's going to have to be really a public-private partnership. And that's probably going to be driven more by small business investment than it is going to be by big corporations or big money doing things in the neighborhoods.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Coming up, overcoming infertility. A collection of stories shows the many ways to build a family.
People are facing more difficulties because they're delaying their family building till later in life.
That's in 20 minutes. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You are listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump certainly appears to be keeping his campaign promise to go after unauthorized immigrants. Federal immigration agents are arresting over 400 immigrants a day. That's a sizable jump from levels a year ago. One of the important tools that ICE uses to find immigrants is the detainer policy that was updated by the president just after he took office. Advocates say this new ICE detainer policy makes it easier for the government to arrest more immigrants. But Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon has directed his staff not to honor ICE detainer requests unless very specific conditions are met. With us now to explain just what this means is Robert Dunlap. He's the chief of jails and courts for the Wayne County Sheriff's Office. Welcome.
Hi.
Would you explain for us, Robert, just what an ICE detainer request is?
So an ICE detainer is a tool used by the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement to identify individuals who are potential deportables when they're held in jails and prisons around the country. Typically, the detainers are issued by an authorized immigration official or a local police officer designated to act as an immigration official under a certain section, 287 of the Immigration and Nationality Act. And so basically, it's a request for a local law enforcement agency to place a hold on an individual who customs enforcement believe might be someone that is deportable from our country.
So does it work by, you know, local police or sheriffs arrest somebody and then say to ICE, hey, we think so-and-so might be deportable? So does it originate from the local police department?
Well, it can, but here in Wayne County, that is not our practice. The only way that the customs enforcement becomes aware of an individual in our custody is maybe through our daily booking records, which are public information. They will review the public booking records, and if they identify someone who they believe is deportable and they actually have a detainer, they'll make a call to us and ask us to place a hold on that individual. However, Sheriff Napoleon has directed that we'll only detain individuals under two conditions. One, there is an actual warrant for that individual, or two, there is written judicial probable cause from a judge or magistrate to hold the individual.
So you're looking for a higher bar, if you will, before you would meet that detainer request.
That's correct, because there are several courts in the United States that have identified detainers as a mere request and not something that's mandatory to law enforcement. And so here in Wayne County, Sheriff Napoleon believes that all of the citizens should have trust and faith and confidence in their government and their local law enforcement and elected officials, and to ensure that they can have that trust here in Wayne County, the sheriff requires those two standards, which are higher than just mere probable cause.
Can you give us a sense, Robert, as far as how did President Trump's executive order change things after it went into effect this past April 2nd?
Well, certainly, I can say it probably change the concerns of people in our communities around the country. Wayne County is the United States. It's very unique, very diverse. Many, ethnicities, backgrounds, races, and cultures exist here in Wayne County. And certainly, as a result of some of the things that President Trump has put in place, there has been a lot of meetings and communications regarding how does that impact the people that live in our communities.
So what message is Sheriff Benny Napoleon sending to the community by refusing to honor these detainer requests without one of these specific conditions being met?
The sheriff is sending a message of trust, hope, and confidence that the citizens in Wayne County could have that we will not engage in a practice of what we believe to be borderline profiling, where we merely just tame people based upon their race or ethnicity. We believe that that is unconstitutional, and of course the sheriff will not engage in that practice.
Do you know of any other local law enforcement agencies in Michigan who have issued similar responses to this new ICE detainer policy?
Well, we know that there are several law enforcement agencies around the country have not taken a look to see exactly who in Michigan has also issued such orders and directives as the sheriff, but there are many, many around the country and probably some here in Michigan.
Now, the ICE statement on its updated detainer policy, I went on their website, and it contains this sentence, and I'm quoting, "When law enforcement agencies fail to honor immigration detainers and release serious criminal offenders, it undermines ICE's ability to protect public safety and carry out its mission." Has Sheriff Napoleon's directive gotten any reaction or any response from ICE?
Well, we believe that our directive is consistent not only with upholding the law and ensuring the citizens in Wayne County that they can have trust and confidence in this agency to not only defend the rights of individuals, but also to fight crime and what we believe the people that are responsible for the violent type crime that are a threat to our community, because we're not wasting time holding individuals just based on mere suspicion alone.
We have seen, Robert, in Texas, the Senate there is considering a bill that would create criminal and civil penalties for law enforcement officials who do not honor all requests from ICE to detain suspected undocumented immigrants. Are you hearing anything about any similar efforts in Michigan?
Have not heard anything about anything like that here in Michigan. But, I would submit, we are in compliance with the law. We understand the law to be here in the United States, that a detainer is simply a mere request, and it allows law enforcement agencies some discretion. And so the way that I would try to frame this for a layperson is, imagine this. The detainer, if we honor the mere request, would say, okay, that person has been adjudicated, free to go, but because of this request, we want you to hold them in jail for another 48 hours. Well, imagine 48 minutes trapped in an elevator simply because someone made a request to stop it in the middle of the floors. How would we feel? That 48 hours, 48 minutes, 48 seconds is no different than that time trapped in the elevator. And I don't believe anyone would consciously think that is something acceptable to do to anyone.
Robert Dunlap is the chief of jails and courts for the Wayne County Sheriff's Office. We want to thank you so much for speaking with us and explaining the policy issued by Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and have a great day.
Singer Lizzie Schell is a newcomer to Michigan's music scene, and now she's out with her debut album, Seed. After struggling with depression and dropping out of college, it was writing and music that helped her heal. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia tells us about this coming-of-age album, revealing some of the artist's deepest fears and hopes.
Lizzie Schell was born in Ypsilanti. She grew up in Arizona and recently moved back to Michigan. Her love for music began at a young age.
My mom says when I was a toddler, we had a little Tykes piano, and she said that I had all of the little sheets of one-line songs memorized by the time I was 3 or 4, and I would make up my own little tunes.
Schell and her family are part of a Pentecostal movement within the Catholic Church. Not only was there music in her home, there was also plenty of philosophical conversations around the dinner table.
A lot of thinking, a lot of critical thinking of not just what are we seeing, but what does it mean and what's the impact on you as a person from the TV that you watch, from the movies you watch, the music you listen to.
Faith and music are important parts of Lizzie's identity.
I am a pretty conservative millennial for all of my peers. I find that there's a lot of things that a lot of my peers experience that I can't relate to because it just hasn't been my life. It hasn't been my story. Kind of the sex, drugs, rock and roll, excitement, pleasure seeking, high seeking. We all have our iterations of that, of course, but I think I've had a very different experience of that than a lot of people.
Staring down the barrel of a straight black line, I'd fall in love, but who has the time? And I never met a heart quite like mine. Satin, tobacco, and turpentine.
Writing, there are subtle references to faith, and it's really interesting to discover. For example, in the song Armored Heart, you write, "The only way I know to fight is to run. Break apart armored heart, break apart alabaster jar." And in the Bible, Mary Magdalene anoints Jesus's feet with perfume from an alabaster jar. What significance does the alabaster jar have for you?
It's one of my favorite stories in scripture. It's a stunning and important piece of literature, if nothing else. But I've heard that alabaster jar described as a jar that doesn't have a lid. Like, it wouldn't be like a mason jar that we would think of. It would have been like one complete box. And so in order to get the oil out, you had to smash the jar and pour all of it. Also, traditionally, that was like what you would use to anoint your husband on the night of your wedding night. Like, that was what you were saving as your heritage, sort of, that you were bringing into your married life. And she was so ready to give that to the person she loved the most. And her courage just, like, blows me away, walking through all these critics and condemnation, just going to the person she loved and saying, have it all.
I'm afraid of love 'cause I'm too young. Fight is to run. The only way I know to fight is to run.
The song is really about giving of my own heart and giving it in fullness and without fear and without reserve and without guardedness or armor. And that image struck me so hard as, like, if you're going to love, you have to break the jar. And giving the whole package, the whole self.
I'm Letting Go is the opening track, and it's the most coming-of-age song on the album. Let's take a listen.
I am already combination of the judgment of my father and the sorrow of my mother. I am the disappointed victim of the long and trying absence of my one and only brother.
yeah, this is really about me accepting some of the deeper pieces of adulthood, moving out on my own and living in a new place and deciding what I want to do with my life and what directions I want to take in terms of my work and my creativity and all these things. I'm letting go of the child that I've been.
Shell went to college, but like many young adults, she began to struggle with depression. She crash-landed at home, dropped out of college, and then had to figure out what was next. In the song, you write, "I'm letting go of this life inside my fist. I'm holding out for the light at the end of all of this."
I think that that chorus, "I'm letting go of the life inside my fist," kind of a recognition that none of us have control. Even if we have a plan and we think we have control, there are so many factors that act in our lives outside of our direct influence that we have to have a trust in something, karma or fate or God or destiny or luck. There's just no way to live thinking that everything is on my shoulders, everything is only my doing, or what a heavy way to live anyway. And so I think there's this releasing of the life in my fist and then this sense of being open-handed then for whatever's going to come my way. I'm holding out for the light at the end of all of this. And I believe there's no meant to be that's ever really missed. I actually stole some of that from a letter that John Steinbeck wrote to his son, a favorite author of mine. And you never miss anything really good. He was writing to his very young son about love in high school. And he just kind of said, if it's meant to be, it'll come. You won't miss it. There's no rush. You don't have to be anxious about playing every card right. And that struck me as such a statement of faith, really, even though he himself was not a man of faith, that there is this confidence and like, what's for me will come to me.
Believing there was light at the end of the tunnel, she took a job in Kansas, working for a Catholic nonprofit organization doing campus outreach. And she did a lot of soul searching and began to write.
Carry me in the arms of the Missouri. Lead me through the trees to the river.
That was a time of total lift. Like, I had totally pulled out of my trajectory in all these other ways and places. It was not something that had been in the cards for me, but I was in a tiny town in Atchison, Kansas, which makes an appearance in one of the songs, Carry Me. It was just small and a slower pace of life. There was really nothing I had to be concerned with except my personal wellness and being a part of this community of people, which is a really, really great community. That was a time of great healing for me.
Let's take a listen to the last track off the album. It's called Buried Alive, and it starts off a bit dark, but there's a lot of hope in this song.
I was buried alive beneath the earth without breath, pushing at the dirt above, desperate for the light. And the sky, I could feel myself breaking.
I loved this song as a closing because it fit so perfectly, just musically and thematically. And I felt so good about ending this record, which was such a dream project for me, on this note of just elevation.
But I was only a seed
sort of rises and crescendos through the end of the song. And I loved that as a direction of the whole album, to say, like, we've been all in this process, we've been wrestling with all these tensions, now let's just, like, soar up, like, get out of the muck and the mire and lift your eyes up. Look, there's good things ahead, there's good things coming, there's growth. Here comes the sun moment of hopefulness.
Lizzie Schell, her debut album, Seed, is out now. She's having a release show on Friday, May 19th in downtown Ypsilanti at Bona Serra Underground. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. My delight. Thank you for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
Some people see the internet as sort of a democratic frontier where anyone from any background can make money or be famous. But the next idea is Jeff DeGraff thinks the power of advertisers and search engines has turned the web into something far less idealistic.
During the recent Academy Awards broadcast, Samsung aired a commercial for its new phone. Casey Neistat, a YouTube and HBO reality personality, narrates over a montage of young people engaged in feats of daring do and uninhibited expressions of creativity. He declares that we are the true makers and maestros, and finishes with this zinger. When we are told that we can't, we all have the same answer. Watch me. And there it is. The glorification of our selfie culture. Apparently, all you need to get people to watch you is a non-exploding phone, astonishing talent, bushels of cash, and an insane amount of luck. Then you, too, can be adored for 90 seconds, the average time a person spends watching an online video. Sure, I love the fact that people are creating and sharing those creations, but I don't believe for a moment that the web is truly as accessible and democratic as many would have us believe. You see, the web is no longer the free and open space it was a decade ago. It's now a feudal system run by a handful of ultra-large and ultra-sophisticated monarchs. The rest of us are just serfs handing over a percentage of our crop to the lords and ladies who have the power to grant us access to the digital world of meaningful commerce. Our chances of actually becoming web royalty are about the same as retiring from that scratch-off lottery ticket. Consider this. Google companies get over 50 billion visits each month. There are only 7.5 billion people on this planet, and only about a third of them have regular internet access. That means that every person visits Google almost every day. The search engine decides what you will find because these visits aren't free. Some company has sponsored your trip on the web and expects the search engine to deliver you to them. Right now, the net is in a consolidation phase. A few big players are gobbling up niche providers and creating enormous storefronts and networks. Sure, there is still infinite variety on the web, but good luck finding it. Look at the retail sector, where 55% of all searches for online products start with Amazon, which also accounts for over half of all the retail growth on the web. The numbers for Facebook, Netflix, and Wikipedia are similar for their own domains. The same thing happened to television in the 1950s, when hundreds of local broadcasters were forced into three networks by the economics of scale. But surely there's still room for your little entrepreneurial dream, noble cause, or heroic work of art. So you pay your web domain, the development of your site, and the fee to your internet service provider to keep things running. Still, that won't get you much traffic unless you have more friends than Kim Kardashian. You spring for a consultant to concoct a magic algorithm to put you atop the search list. And perhaps you even go for some banner ads, hoping they don't accidentally pop up in the middle of some troll's little hate fest. You keep this up in perpetuity because it's the price you have to pay to belong to the digital world. You now realize that the web has become a glorified phone book. We can't watch you because we can't find you. Regrettably, those that are most adept at finding us are commercially or ideologically motivated. Don't believe me? Well, I'm posting this to a website where, as you know, everything you read is true.
Jeff DeGraff is an expert on innovation at the Ross School of Business and our partner on The Next Idea.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
One of the greatest challenges a couple can face is infertility. That struggle of trying to conceive can be so overwhelming, you feel you're the only one going through it. Which is why a Michigan couple has come out with a book that shares 10 different couples' experiences with infertility, including their own. And it serves a great big dose of encouragement for anyone who thinks that they are alone in their infertility struggles. Sue Johnston and Bob Johnston are co-authors of Detours, Unexpected Journeys of Hope Conceived from Infertility. Both of you with us now. You tell us in your book that 1 in 8 couples struggle with infertility issues. Is that a higher rate than in past years? Are we seeing more and more couples having infertility issues?
Well, I do believe that it is a higher rate than in the past because most people are getting beyond high school and getting into higher education, so they're delaying their attempts at pregnancy. And the more you delay your attempts at pregnancy, the longer you delay it. The eggs only have a certain number of years that they can be fertilized. And so, yeah, people are facing more difficulties because they're delaying their family building till later in life.
Every chapter in your book brings a different couple's story, and we begin with yours. It struck me that you both kind of figured when pregnancy didn't just happen in your first year of marriage, hey, don't worry, it'll eventually happen. I bet that's a pretty common theme, isn't it, Bob?
Oh, I think it is. I think that you always think as you were going through life, you know, you don't want to get pregnant at the wrong time or with the wrong person and that. And then when you find the right person and you embark on your journey together, then you kind of expect, oh, okay, that they always kind of scared you about is going to happen. And for a lot of people, it doesn't.
How long did it take until you started worrying when it got past the, hey, don't worry, it'll happen, to I think we have a problem?
Well, I've always been rather educated about family building and whatnot. And I knew that because I was 28 years old, I shouldn't delay pregnancy. And I tried for a year. I mean, I didn't wait. On our honeymoon, we started trying and I just really wanted to have children. So we sought infertility treatment with our regular OBGYN after about a year.
As we learn from reading your accounts, and I really like the fact we get it from both your perspectives, Sue and Bob, that you had one heck of an ordeal. How many years total?
It was 10 years in trying to build our family. We actually got pregnant after 7 years of trying, but all told, we tried for number two, and we never did get another child. So it was 10 years of surgeries, shots, high technology, infertility meds, just it was ongoing, a nightmare.
And you're very honest about
yeah,
all that. And
yeah.
Bob, as you and Sue were pursuing your dream of becoming parents, you were going after a professional dream to become the captain of a U.S. Navy warship. How much away time did that require of you?
We always say in the Navy, it's one of the jokes that we're the only profession that can guarantee you a happy marriage half the time. So if you're not happy with your spouse, they're gone half the time. If you're happy with them, they're home half the time. So I was a surface warfare officer. And what that means is I was a officer on surface ships, cruisers and destroyers was what I did. When we first moved to San Diego, after being married a little bit over a year, we moved into a house that I had already owned in San Diego. And about a week later, the household goods had been delivered. She drove me to the ship. I drew her a map on how to get home, and then I left for 3 months. And then you are in and out of San Diego, wherever your home port is, for about half the time, and then you deploy overseas. In March of 88, we left for 7 months. That's kind of the life that I led.
Which, understanding what it takes to try to get pregnant with all of the things you're going through, that really complicated things.
It really did, because, well, he was gone about 7 years of time. If you put it all together in the 14 years that we were together trying all of this, we've been married 31 years, but he was gone, like you said, half the time.
So, and as you say, so much of what you went through was very, very physically uncomfortable.
Oh,
it
was.
A lot of invasive things. And for you, Bob, as you share in your stories, you know, here the man becomes entirely way too familiar with cups and girly magazines.
Correct.
But that's about it for the physical side. But I can only imagine the emotional side, because you two are coping with the disappointing news each month. At the same time, you're watching your life partner go through all of this. That was a lot to carry.
Yeah, it was. And the fact that my profession was forcing me to be away. And then for 2.5 years, we were transferred to the Philippines. And this type of technology wasn't available there. We were on a Navy base. There was one doctor up at Clark Air Force Base that did a little bit of this on the side, but not much. All test results had to be mailed back to San Antonio. And the only way to get there between our base and that base was on a plane or a helicopter that went the 35 miles because it was too unsafe to travel by land. So it was the push-pull of my career goals, our family goals, and then how the Navy did it. You can't say, well, I think I'll be captain of a ship in about 5 years. Once the offer is given, that's it. And if you don't take it, it will never be given again. That was a large amount of stress. I had to go to Newport, Rhode Island for 6 months of training while she stayed in San Diego.
You weren't happy with that, I recall.
Well, you know, it was very challenging.
Well, you're emotional anyway.
Yes, yes. And you're on all of these ovulating stimulating medications and things that kind of, you know, make your hormones go haywire. And we women have a biological time clock, and mine was ticking loudly.
Thundering.
It was thundering because I just felt like I was going to miss that window of opportunity. I just felt like my life would not be fulfilled without being a mother.
As we learn in reading in your book, Detours, you did finally succeed in hearing those magical words. You're pregnant after all those years.
Right.
What was that moment like?
Oh, my goodness. It was just unbelievable. Well, Bob had come back from sea. Actually, I was supposed to get the pregnancy test the day before you came back from sea.
Right.
And I waited another day to get the pregnancy test so that we could go together.
To hear the good news or the bad
news. To hear the good news or the bad news,
sure.
Yes. So his ship pulled in. I went on board, and he took my hand, and we went off and got blood work, and we had to wait 8 hours for the blood work to be processed and for the nurse to call us back. And
so one of the first questions she asked me, so how was your week at sea? And I said, it was horrible. We had gone to do a test of the anchor system, and it had failed, and we had lost a 45-ton anchor.
So it was off of San Clemente. Wasn't a good day.
It wasn't my favorite week.
No,
it wasn't my favorite week. We had talked once on the phone through a radio system. Cell phones really weren't that capable then. And she had said she was feeling differently than she had felt before. She actually thought she had an ectopic pregnancy. So she came in, as she said, and picked me up, and then we went and had the blood test. And to kill time, we actually went to a movie, and it was the Fugitive movie that came out.
Yeah.
And we watched that,
every detail.
And then we got home.
And then they finally called. We had always planned in advance to, you know, answer the phone together. So it was like 1, 2, 3, pick up the phone, pick up the phone. And so we were on separate lines, and the nurse from the blood lab called, and she goes, I have great news for you. You're pregnant. And I just felt like this emotion that welled from within me that I just goosebumps all over to this day just thinking about it. And I really just couldn't believe. I kept saying, is it real? Is it real? Because I really didn't feel good. And come to find out, I had hyperstimulated, and that is what was causing me to feel so sick. And sometimes hyperstimulation can be a sign of a positive pregnancy, which I didn't know.
The fact that your son, Scott, is
yes.
a senior at the University
yes.
of Michigan means it's
yes.
all good. It all worked
yes.
out.
Yes, yes.
And in your book, then, you pull together couples who have many different stories. How
yes.
did you all come together?
Well, we met through the Resolve National Infertility Support Association of Greater San Diego after we got back from the Philippines. That's when I started really high-tech intervention, and I felt like I needed a support group, especially since my husband was gone all the time. And so I met this core group of women. There were nine others, myself and Bob, and you know, people would come and people would go in this infertility support group, and they would get pregnant and drop out, but we... The 10 of us just seemed to remain. We couldn't get pregnant. We couldn't stay pregnant no matter what. And years went by, and we're still there, lifelines for each other. Eventually, one after the other, in different years, in different ways, we all reached our resolution.
And yes. that's the – there are different journeys.
Right, different journeys. Yes, we all had roadblocks and setbacks and detours, so that's why we named the book Detours. We even have one that couldn't get pregnant no matter what she tried, and she chose to remain child-free after all this high-tech intervention.
So no matter what someone's going through
right.
in their life, they'll probably mm-hmm. find a story that resonates
right.
in your book, Detours.
Exactly.
I have to ask, because I know you must have been asked, especially as you were going through all of these
mm-hmm.
disappointments
mm-hmm.
and that, why not adopt?
Well, that's a great question, and any infertile couple who has gone through it as much as we have is always asked that, and we reflect on that. And for me personally, I was unexplained infertility. And the doctors kept telling me that I had picture-perfect cycles. And that makes it so difficult to let go of that dream. They kept saying, we don't see any reason why you can't conceive. You have a thick endometrium lining. You have lots and lots of eggs. You have lots and lots of sperm and make beautiful embryos that develop to blastocyst. And we're transferring these picture-perfect embryos, and we don't understand.
So it was so tantalizingly close,
yeah.
you didn't want to let it go.
Right.
Well, I think the other part is that adoption isn't an easy road either. And we knew a number of people that started down that road, and they got close to the end, and then something happened. And then there was all the press about... In fact, I think it was here in Ann Arbor, mm-hmm. the DeBoer case.
Yes. And just to kind of remind everybody, that was in 1993, and that was when an Ann Arbor adoptive couple, the DeBoers, wound up having to give their daughter, 2-year-old Jessica, back to her birth parents.
Exactly. And that was when I was in the thick of my infertility treatment. So that really resonated with me. But I do feel that adoption is a wonderful option for so many people, and it can be a happily ever after story for so many.
You're going to be in Washington for Resolve's Advocacy
right.
Day.
Mm-hmm.
What's the message of the rally, and to whom is it aimed?
Well, it is basically an advocacy day to meet with our congressmen and women to lobby for their three bills in Congress right now that are really vital to the infertility community. One is IVF for vets. One is a Personhood Act. And the other is tax refunds for people who adopt, an adoption tax refund. And when I read about these issues and how greatly they can affect if they're passed or, you know, if they're rejected, they can affect, you know, the infertility community too. I thought, I have got to go and be that voice. There are 200 advocates coming from around the nation, and I needed to be there. My husband is a vet. I went through IVF, and I feel like many of my friends have adopted, and we have an adoption story in our chapter. And yeah, I felt called to go.
And you can find out more about the book Detours, Unexpected Journeys of Hope Conceived from Infertility, as well as following Sue and Bob's blog by going to detoursofhope.com. Sue Johnston and Bob Johnston, I guess 23 years later, congratulations.
Thank
Wasn't that
you.
Just
quite
the journey?
Thank you.
But
yes.
as you say, the unexpected journey of hope. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and Cass Adair. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.